Lots of times when I work with people, I see them cycling around to a deeper and deeper understanding of themselves, of their situations, of their life in some way. And as I sit here today, I'm recognizing that in my own life, and that's so encouraging, that as a new believer, I understood God's love, who He was, in one way. And yet I've cycled around many, many times and come to a deeper and deeper understanding of what it is to be a mature believer, to be a person that loves God. And that's the topic of our discussion today.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
If I speak with the tongues of men and angels, but do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith, so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. That is such a beautiful passage. So many times in weddings, we hear this whole 1 Corinthians 13 passage, and it's always just a poem. It's always such a song in my ear, and it so much emphasizes the necessity of love and the importance, the prominence of love in our lives above and beyond anything. But Jack, this passage on love comes in between, kind of sandwiched in between, two sections on spiritual gifts. Why is that?
Well, we might have mentioned this in our last session, but the end of chapter 12 ends, "Earnestly desire the greater gifts." And then he says immediately after that, "But I show you a still more excellent way." And then chapter 13, the one you just started to read about love, begins.
So he's saying, want the spiritual gifts, but there's something much more important.
Exactly.
Then that's love.
Right, and it's love. And then the crucial thing is to define what he means by love, and that's not easy to do. We use it in weddings. We look at this passage when we are trying to promote love for one another, brotherly love, love for my neighbor, love for my enemies. We use it in all kinds of different ways. But almost universally, in modern times, we understand this to be love for our fellow human beings in one way, shape, or form. It was striking to me when I was reading Augustine one time that it became apparent that he thinks the love that's being talked about here is the love of God. And initially, I just kind of looked at that and went, well, you know, Augustine, what does he know?
That's kind of what I was just thinking. What does Augustine know, Jack?
And there was a good reason to be skeptical, because he's coming out of, he was influenced very heavily by Platonism, by the teaching of Plato early in his life, and all of Christianity back in his day was very strongly influenced by Greek philosophy. And it was very easy for them to think that the only kind of love that really counted was the love of what was absolute. And so I was ready to dismiss it of just, well, you know, he's just a product of his culture. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's just thinking like a Platonist here. And clearly, 1 Corinthians 13 is talking about love for one another. But the more I've looked at the chapter, the more I've become persuaded that Augustine is actually right, not in his Platonism, but in his understanding of the chapter. This is a different kind of love that he has in mind than what we first think of when we read the chapter. It's not love for a fellow believer, not love for a neighbor, not love for a wife or husband. It's the love of God he has in mind. I mean, I think that's a controversial conclusion, and I think that's debatable. I mean, I can certainly understand people arguing that, no, clearly he means love for other people, but I want to make the case for the love of God.
Okay, go for it, but you've got a skeptic here.
Okay. Well, in favor of your skepticism, you have things like, look at all these things that seem to define a loving response to another human being. Love is patient. Love is kind, is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly. It does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered. I mean, right off the bat, you have, what, 8 or 10 attributes that very, very clearly define a good, compassionate, unselfish, loving relationship to another person and how I should treat a fellow human being. But then it turns, and then it becomes more problematic. Love does not rejoice in unrighteousness. Well, could that be defining an attribute of love for other people? Well, it could, certainly, because if I'm acting in a loving manner toward you, I won't rejoice in any unrighteousness toward you.
You won't be glad when I mess up, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I won't. Yeah, exactly.
You won't, like, revel in, oh, good, she finally goofed.
Right. Or if you were the victim of somebody else's unrighteousness, I'm not going to rejoice in that if I am loving toward you. So that could go either way. The next one, but rejoices with the truth. Okay. I could look at that as something that's loving toward you. I only want the truth to be known about you. I don't want anybody to lie or slander or abuse you in any way by using falsehood to do so. Could take it that way. On the other hand, rejoices with the truth could mean, more generally, I take joy in just the truth itself in any context, wherever, for whatever reason. Now, related to you or not, just truth because it's truth could mean that. And if that's the case, then we're not really talking about a relationship with other people. We're actually talking about a relationship with the truth. So what do we do with that? Bears all things? Again, sounds like my relationship with other people, or could anyway. Believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. And here's where I finally capitulated to Augustine. Believes all things could mean believes all things about the other person, but in what way is that loving? What would I mean, believes all things relative to another person? It's not loving to somebody to be gullible. It's not loving to somebody to just take their every word for everything without being critical, without being discerning, so on. I mean, there's nothing loving about that. That's actually pretty unloving to be that way. So that doesn't make any sense. There was no way I could take that without stretching the meaning of believes all things that sounded like an attribute of love for another human being. But if I take it out of that context and take it into the context of that the Bible puts me in, am I or am I not willing, able, prepared, ready to believe what is true about who God is and what he's up to in the world? That's constantly put forward by the Bible as a test of my relationship with God. If I'm in rebellion against God, I'm in rebellion against the truth of who he is and what he's up to in the world. If I'm not in rebellion against God, I'm ready to believe the truth about God and what he's up to in the world. So, as a test of my love of God, that's a perfectly biblical, perfectly central kind of idea. As a test of whether or not I love you, I can't even really make any sense out of it. Same with hopes all things. As a measure of whether or not I love you, what would it mean to hope all things? I come up empty. I mean, I could imagine some narrow sense in which it might make sense, but it would be a stretch. On the other hand, if you put it in the context of my relationship to God, it's the same as believes all things. Do I or do I not invest my life and my hope in what God has promised me? Or do I disregard what God has promised me as irrelevant and uninteresting, as valueless? That's the test of what kind of person I am, of what kind of heart I have toward God, and is always put forth as that throughout the Bible. So in this context, if it's talking about the love of God, then it makes sense that that's on the list. As a love for you, I can't make any sense out of it. And then I go back to, having seen that, does not rejoice in unrighteousness. Well, that's an absolutely central test of whether or not I love God, if I take it in the broadest possible sense. The one who loves God loves righteousness. The one who does not love God loves evil. or at least does not love righteousness. So it obviously makes sense as a central key test of my love. If it's the love of God, it becomes kind of tangential if it's a love for you. Then I go back to
a little bit behind, but is this okay. A love that I have toward God or a love that God has toward me?
My love for God, toward God. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember if we've talked about this before or not, but as I would understand what the Bible means by the love of God, love toward God, my love of God, it basically comes down to really two attitudes I can take toward God. Either in the final analysis, having got to know Him and know what He's up to and what He's doing with the world and His value system and His priorities, either like Him for all of that or I don't like Him for all of that. And the Bible presents that as kind of a watershed characteristic of where I'm at spiritually. There are the children of God who are the people who love God for who He is, and there are the children of the devil who in the final analysis hate God for who He is. They reject God. And that's the sense of the love of God that I think He's defining here. To love God is to like what God likes, to share His heart, His value system, His priorities. It's to resonate with God and who He is, which is not always easy to do. You know, I mean, love of God does not come easy to us. We look at the tragedy that God brings into people's lives, the suffering He brings into people's lives. God puts this premium on things like wisdom that is only won through pain and grief and sorrow. And we wonder whether His priorities are right. You know, we wonder whether we even like a God who would make that His priorities. And we struggle with that. But in the final analysis, those of us who love God have somehow, miraculously, supernaturally, had our eyes open to the point where we see, you know, that actually, it's really good that God is who He is and that He has the values and priorities He has. It's a right thing, not a wrong thing. And I love Him for it. I don't hate Him for it. Many people in the world hate God for being who He is. I think that's what's behind where Paul is beginning here. The love of God is the more excellent way. And then he goes on to describe in some really practical terms, concrete terms, well, what do I mean by the love of God? What does that look like? And much of it has to do with how we treat other people. To love God is to love my peer, my fellow creature. If I don't love my fellow creature, I don't love God.
Okay, so that's how you're tying in the things that really look like they're human-to-human love.
Right.
Because they are.
They are, yeah.
But they've got a broader frame around them, which is, this is how I love God.
By being patient, by being kind, not being jealous, not bragging and not being arrogant, not being provocative.
Okay, so I'm not as much of a skeptic now, because really those are human-to-human things.
Right.
And I think it's just a great lesson in how we love God is by loving each other. That's what makes it really tangible.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So, again, Jack, why would he put such a profound lesson on love, loving God by loving each other, into this, you know, kind of sandwich it in between the spiritual gifts lessons?
Right. Well, because if you remember our previous programs, 1 Corinthians 12 is not about spiritual gifts because he wants to teach about spiritual gifts. It's about spiritual gifts because he wants to talk about the working of the Spirit of God. What is the authentic, genuine operation of the Spirit? What is its effect? What does it accomplish? And what he's arguing is, while the Spirit of God does produce the effect through my ministry and through these things that we call spiritual gifts, it's not only that, and it's not most importantly that. The most important thing that the Spirit accomplishes is by creating true spirituality. In chapter 12, he talked about that in terms of confessing that Jesus is Lord. That's true spirituality. Now he's changing it. It's the same thing for him, but he's getting at it from a different angle. What does the Spirit of God produce in me? It produces the love of God. And that's authentic, true spirituality. The love of God in all of its manifestations and all the difference that makes in the way I act in this world, that's true, authentic spirituality. And all the operation of spiritual gifts in the world don't hold a match to being a person who loves God. Don't hold a match, is that what I mean? Don't hold a, what's the phrase?
Candle.
Don't hold a candle. they just can't compare. I mean, they're just worthless by comparison. And see, that's how he starts. if I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, that is, but I don't love God, so what? I'm a noisy gong and a clanging cymbal. No big deal. I'm a worthless, valueless. And if we remember back to our previous discussion, it's so radically different from the way the Corinthians are thinking about this. The Corinthians are thinking that speaking in tongues is so dramatic, is such a flashy, flamboyant manifestation of the Spirit, they think, that that's got to be kind of the real hallmark of real, intense, authentic spirituality. And Paul is saying, no, not at all. That's not true at all. It's the quiet, mundane, ordinary, everyday love of God that is the most striking, remarkable, and profoundly authentic spirituality that there is.
Okay, so the outline, if we had it here before us, would be, A, these passages are talking about spirituality. So, number one under this subtopic is, he's using spiritual gifts as a way to get at telling you that a real, authentic belief in God is what is true spirituality, not something that is kind of a frenzied emotional experience.
Right.
It's much more staid than that. And then the second subtopic would be of true spirituality is love. Love is really evidence of you being a spiritual person. And this is the way that we love.
Right, exactly. The love of God, which involves love for my fellow human being, love of truth, love of righteousness, openness to God and his purposes, believing the truth about what God is doing in the world, and hoping in those promises. And I probably missed something there, but those are the manifestations of a person who loves God, and therefore those are the manifestations of somebody in whom the Spirit of God has truly worked his work and has had his effect.
Okay, and as you're saying that, I'm thinking, well, maybe someday we can come back and do a whole longer program on love, because we're just kind of going over it as a means to bring us to this other passage, which is chapter 14. So should we go on to that?
Okay. Yeah. Let me make one further comment about 13 before we do that. It's been really striking to me in recent years to realize how central the love of God is. And I think most of my Christian experience, I have thought this way, and I see a lot of Christians around me thinking this way, that God is sort of a prop to promote and a catalyst to promoting love between people, that the real valuable thing is love between human beings. That's the real value. And we see that in the culture. I mean, how many times all kinds of secular people who have no spiritual interest at all will promote the value of love in the world. You know, what does the world need? We just need a whole lot more love. That's what we need. That's a very easy thing for people in our culture to say. But they would be outraged to hear Paul's perspective on that, because Paul's perspective on that is what the world needs is to love God. And we're okay with loving God as long as we just see loving God as a means to a greater end. And what is the greater end? That we as people love one another. If he's some kind of catalyst to that, or he's kind of an idea that promotes love between people, then that's okay for God to be a good idea that kind of promotes love between people. But to take God himself seriously and get to know God and see how he's running his universe and see how he's running history and respond to that positively, that's a radically offensive kind of thing for most modern people. And yet Paul is saying that's what's central. You even see that wrong priority, that inversion, I think, entering into evangelicals who are getting involved in the social political debate and concerns of our day. It's almost like Christianity is a means to giving me a value system that I can export to my government to make my government better, to make my civilization better, to make it run more smoothly. And you often wonder, but would you be okay with America becoming a more civilized society, but hating God? Would you be okay with that? And you have to wonder if they wouldn't be okay with that sometimes, that's the end. The end of my life needs to be to come to terms personally, individually, with the God who is there, and decide what I think about him. Do I like him or don't I like him? Am I willing to obey him or am I not interested in obeying him? Do I want to serve him or not serve him? That's the question of my life, ultimately. And I have to confront him on those terms, not just as some kind of distant, remote, abstract idea that really doesn't mean anything more than, do I want to be a civilized person establishing justice in the world? That's not enough. That doesn't really confront me with the real issue of my life. Now, I don't know if I've been clear, but it's a very different priority.
Yeah. This is a soapbox, isn't it?
I suppose, yeah. It's new to me. It's a new insight to me, because I think I have myself not been fully aware of how much this is about God, how central God is to this whole thing.
Okay, I guess my understanding of what you said is kind of like lights flickering in my mind, but not a whole light turning on in the room. So I think it's an important insight, and I think I'd like to spend some more time on it. Would that be okay?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Because perhaps people in the audience like myself have grasped a part of what you're saying, but I'm not quite grounded on it.
Okay.
So I'll tell you what I think I hear, and let's work with it. Well, Jack, I'm trying to think about how to say it, and I'm just going to have to plunge in somewhere, all right?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So I think you would agree that it is very important to love our fellow human beings.
Yes.
And that loving our fellow human beings is very much evidence toward the fact that we love God, or if we don't love our fellow human beings, evidence that we don't love God.
Right.
It can be an evidence. And so in what you're saying, you're not trying to diminish that important truth.
Not at all, no.
And in fact, you said earlier in 1 Corinthians 13 that it starts by showing us how we love God is by loving other people. So we take that one off the list first. But you're saying that is sometimes the entire emphasis that we in our culture have toward love, that it's only about loving each other, which makes sense with non-Christians. But you're saying as a Christian, as a believer, there's this bigger being that I love, which is God.
Mm-hmm.
And I really need to have my focus become bigger than just loving each other. It needs to expand. I have to admit that although that makes sense to me, and although I think it flickers in my mind is very true, I think I am guilty of really bringing it down to a very humanistic place. My faith has a lot to do with loving you, and I think that makes my faith and my love for God thin. You're encouraging us to look at loving God as something that's preeminent in our lives. We can't just love people and forget, oh yeah, God. But we need to have God as preeminent in our life all the time. So that we're not just, for example, going out and wanting to promote no abortion as a social issue. That's a really good thing. But we could have a whole society of people who are abiding by the rule of no abortion, but whose hearts have not been changed by the Spirit of God. Right. And that's what you mean by having a godless society. I could have no abortion in this society, but I might lose my life in terms of my spiritual life, my eternal life, my life with God, because I have just learned to do good things rather than recognizing that the crux of the issue is God making me into a good person.
Yeah, I mean, notice one of the things he says in 1 Corinthians 13. If I give all my possessions to feed the poor, the hungry, and if I surrender my body to be burned, but do not have love, it profits me nothing. It's hard for me to decide which of two things he means there. They're both true, I think. One is that I can get involved in a larger cause, feeding the poor, for example, at the level of a movement or a cause or a grand thing that I'm accomplishing, and not have any love for the people involved. I think that's true, and I think we see that all the time. It's easy to love the poor as an abstraction. It's much more difficult to love an actual poor person who's before me. And it's the latter that's the test of my character, not the first. and no big deal that I'm involved in some social political movement that's accomplishing some good thing if my character is no good, that I'm not accomplishing anything that's of any profit to me. That could be what he's saying, and it could be all that he's saying, and if he's saying that, that's certainly true. But I wonder if he's not saying more than that, and that is, forget the movements. What if I, just as on a one-to-one person level with an individual poor person, I were to feed them out of an act of love for them, an act of compassion, an act of mercy, a legitimate act of love, but I didn't have love for God? What does that profit me? Because I think that's true also, and that may in fact be what he means by that statement. What if you genuinely love another human being, but you don't love God? Where's the profit in that? Where's the profit in that, not for the other person, but where's the profit in that for you? Because that's what he says. It profits me nothing.
Okay, so you're saying that if I truly love somebody, I'm not just obeying a rule to say not abort a baby, but I'm truly deciding, for example, to love that child inside of me. That's a good thing for that child. That's a loving thing for that child. But ultimately, there's a bigger question.
Exactly.
And the bigger question is, have I really loved God? So we need to go back to the discussion we had earlier on, so what in the world does loving God look like?
Okay.
And I'm going to try to say it.
Okay.
Can I?
Yeah.
Because I think you've told us, and I guess I need to get my brain working here, Jack. Okay. This is hard work, and I think that understanding this kind of stuff really is hard work, and if I just rely on you telling me, I haven't done the work that's hard, and then I forget it. Then yeah. It isn't part of me.
Yeah.
And I would encourage our audience, too, with that. This is hard work to get. It's certainly not easy for me, and if it's not easy for you, boy, that sure makes a lot of sense for me. I think that deciding not to have the abortion could very much be what loving God is, on one hand. Because it may be, for example, that I have a picture of myself that I want to promote to other people. I want them to see me, perhaps, as a very moral person who wouldn't have sex outside of marriage. Perhaps this is the situation, and then become pregnant. And so in order to avoid that appearance of someone different than I want to show, I might then have an abortion, and not to have an abortion would perhaps be an act of obedience that says, okay, God, I'm going to trust you, even though this is going to really shift people's perspective of me, but I'm going to live in obedience to you because that's more important to me than anything. Even though I'm going to be humiliated, I might be misunderstood, I'm going to be seen differently by other people, but this is a huge step towards saying, toward displaying the love that I have for you. I want what's good more than I want to protect myself from what I'm afraid of. And from that perspective, I really am loving God, not just the child, and I am loving myself because I'm truly giving myself something that's real and truthful and good, and I'm not just protecting myself from what I'm afraid of. So that's one way that I might really be loving God.
Mm-hmm.
But that brings me into the bigger picture, because loving God has to do with, like you said, a lot of suffering. Am I willing in this situation to face into what's scary for me or to protect myself from my fear? Isn't that how it is across the board with life all the time and faith all the time? The bigger question is, am I willing to take from the hand of God what he wants me to have? Or am I going to defiantly define how I think God should make my life? A great example of that is when I was young and was going into counseling, I thought about being a person that was able to help other people, and that I would be in this role of kind of a little bit of saving people. And what I've come to know in the work that I've done, especially with people who have been traumatized, is there is no way in this world that I can save people. Those people in particular who are in such agony, and even people in less agony who are in the midst of regular things that are very difficult, like divorce or like the suicide of a friend. Those are very difficult issues. they're not as traumatic as some people experience. But sometimes, very often, I'm only able to sit in the pain with other people. And have had the question come up to me so many times, is God a good God? Is God a loving God that would give us this kind of life, which to some people is no life at all? Or is one tragedy after another tragedy? Why would God give somebody a life who's become a multiple personality in order just to survive the Auschwitz of their childhood? The question for me is, do I love God in the midst of those realities?
Question for you as a counselor hearing this, or as if you were that person?
Either.
Both. Okay.
Both. Mm-hmm. Because there's something that rises in me that says a loving God doesn't do that. And even more difficult is, what about the people that he destines for hell?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a loving God? I mean, one thing to say, these people who are going through hell here, at least they have salvation waiting and hope waiting for them. But some people don't have that. And so the question has come up to me so many times, is God a loving God? Am I willing to submit to him even though I see this? And the answer from deep within me, over and over through struggle, is yes. And I feel grounded in that. But that's the kind of love of God that he's asking us for, not where it's easy, but where it's very difficult. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
And do I love God who puts me in a position where I'm in, all I can do is be in pain with these people? That's all that I have, is to lay with them, to sit with them, to hear them empathically, completely in their pain, and know that I have no way of saving them from it, period.
Right.
Is God a loving God that would bring me, who eagerly wanted to be a counselor, into this place of being a counselor that faces into the deepest of hells with people? Is it okay with me that God gave me that job,
mm-hmm.
that journey, that lifetime commitment?
Right. The question is, why describe that kind of submission to God's sovereign purposes, that acceptance of it? Why use the word love to describe that? You know, why the love of God? Why not just resignation to God? I mean, that's what the Islam calls it. Islam means resignation. Why the love of God? Where is that coming from?
It sounds
from?
Like embracing rather than giving into.
Exactly. Exactly.
It sounds like going toward rather than, okay, I'll give in.
Right. And I think that's intentional. I think that is what it's trying to describe, is it's not just, I'm not tough enough to fight it, so I guess I have to put up with it. But it's the ability to look back and ultimately say, this is a good thing that God is doing here. Now, that can be confusing because there's so much we don't understand. I mean, there's so much that is a mystery to us. I mean, how many times do we cry out, what on earth are you doing, God? I'm sure you do that a lot.
Oh, man, I do it all the time. So my conclusion that God is a loving God and that I want to go toward him in love, it comes with saying, and I don't get it.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it in the big picture, but I don't know why you got hit by yes, one more thing, person, mm-hmm. or that I ended up in one more difficult situation.
Right. But you and I have seen enough in life that have made sense, and it's those things that seem clear to us that speak louder to us than the things that mystify us. So we allow those things that mystify us, we kind of sit back and go, well, I don't get what you're doing there, God, but I know you. I know who you are now. I've seen who you are. I've seen glimpses of your goodness and your purposes and how wonderful they are.
And it's bigger.
And it's bigger, yeah. And so this thing that mystifies me must make sense in the light of some purposes that I don't understand, because I do know you. You know, that's how we can go on confessing that God is good, even though not everything makes sense to us.
It just seems like even when the darkness covers up all the big good that I could see yesterday. Somehow the good has become, the understanding of God being good has become so real to me that it's like water seeping out from under a carpet. You know, it kind of finds its way out. And
the goodness of God.
The goodness of God kind of finds its way out, even though it feels really covered. It bleeds out, and I find it again. Mm-hmm. It just keeps on coming up.
Yeah, that's good. For me, I think of it this way. Although I'm not naturally inclined to see God as my creator and me as his creation, I can easily forget that. As we go through our everyday lives, we really think of ourselves as peers of God, if not in fact his judge and his superior. I mean, that's a more natural position for us to take. When we get to know God, we realize he's the creator. He's the author of my very existence. And as the author of my very existence, it really is his prerogative to call the shots in my life, to put on my life the constraints that are there, the restrictions that are there, the limitations that are there in my life. And life then poses a question to me. What do you think about the God who has given you the existence that he's given you with all of its limitations and all of its restrictions and all of the sacrifices you're having to make? What do you think about the God who's the author of your being? And I'm ultimately going to answer that in one of two ways. I'm either going to go, you know, I like him. With all that he's done, with all that he's made me, with all of the negative aspects to the experience that he's made my experience, nonetheless, I've come to see that the author of my being is a good guy, and I like him, and I want him to do his purposes. I really want him to get on with his purposes because I trust him. I trust his character. That's to love God. That's to have come to a point where my knowledge of God has resulted in my being able to genuinely from the heart, authentically from the heart, saying, you know, I like him. I really like him. Most people don't get to that point. Most people actually come to the conclusion, you know, frankly, I hate him. I hate him for everything he's done in my life. I hate him for taking that away from me. I hate him for doing that to me. I hate him for doing this other thing for me. I hate him. He's destroyed my life. He's the destroyer. That's frankly where most people, if they ever articulate their thoughts at all, that's their thoughts. Those are the people who don't love God.
I think certainly for me and a lot of people that I know, getting to the place of saying, you know, God is a good God certainly comes through going through times of saying, I hate God.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All of us have probably said that at one time or another.
I thought it or it was somewhere there where I really struggled with, I can't believe that you would do this, God, and you're not a good God. And now I have to say, overall, I see God as a good God, but I struggle with, but I don't like this thing that you're doing here. I really wish you'd do it different, and I'm kind of mad at you. And that isn't sustained. It doesn't stay, and it isn't as intense as it used to be, but I would hate to give people the impression that we have this one solid commitment and we always know that we think God's a great God and that we like him. I think that comes to be challenged all the time. Sure. Every time there's a struggle in our life that's significant, what comes to mind, if my husband died today, I would really struggle. Mm-hmm. And you would hear my struggle. Mm-hmm. And I know from, or I hope I know, that from what I know about God, I'd come out and say, God's a good God. I think I would eventually know that again. But I would go through a lot of difficulty. And then that's just natural to human beings.
And I think we've made this comment before. It doesn't matter how much we thrash along the way. What determines the condition of my heart is where I land, not how gracefully I land there, but whether I land at all. Do I land, as you suggest that you would, with being able to say, God is a good God? But how gracefully we come to that conclusion is of really no consequence. It's, where am I headed?
I think it's more, where am I headed? Mm-hmm. Because I may not even land ever. If something is so completely traumatic in my life, or many, many traumas over a long period of time, I might just be headed in the direction of saying, I want to know God, I want to love God, I want to see, but not be able to see, and die in that quest to want God. That's not a clenched fist. That's not a set jaw against God. That's going toward him. Mm-hmm. But I just have been so wounded that I just can't squint hard enough to see him.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's a point well taken. The level of our conviction, the level of clarity with which we see, that's all up to God. That's his business. The issue is as you say, just am I headed away or am I headed toward? And that's really the only criterion in the end.
Mm-hmm. And Jack, it could be that the fact that you are, it looks like where you've come, where you say God is a really good God, could be an easier thing for you to say. That you're kind of landed on that than somebody who's not landed at all. For them to even be headed in that direction could have taken much, much more courage, but look very far less
right.
than your ending conviction here.
Yeah, I buy that.
You've got to ask the question, how wounded was that person? How difficult were their life circumstances such that their struggle is immensely more difficult than your own?
Right.
And so we can't measure even maturity or spirituality by how far have we gotten? Where have we landed? But are we on the journey?
Yeah, I don't think we can measure spirituality by that. I think we can measure maturity by that, because maturity is a measure of how close am I to what is ideal? How close am I to what is complete?
Okay. Yes.
But you're right. You can't measure spirituality by that. That's
okay.
True.
And there's a distinction between those two.
Yeah.
You're always so good at words, Jack, kind of clarifying exactly what things mean.
I don't know if I have time to make this point clearly enough, but I've been studying the Old Testament more and more in recent years, and the thing that's been striking about the prophets is they will make this big, huge deal to people who are about to be overrun by the Babylonians, for example. There are these people in Judah who are going to be judged. Why? Because their heart was not right before God. They did not love God, you know, back to the very thing that we've been talking about. And God is bringing in the Babylonians to judge them. Well, what's going to happen? What's going to happen is the Babylonians are going to come. He's going to kill many of them. He's going to rape their wives. He's going to take into captivity their children. He's going to destroy their vineyards and their houses. I mean, all these incredible things are going to happen to them. And the prophet is saying, be comforted. And you look at that and you go, be comforted.
What in the world?
My whole life is going to be turned upside down. It's going to be destroyed. And you're telling me, be comforted. On what basis? What exactly is the comfort? And as it turns out, the comfort is God made a promise to your father Abraham centuries ago, and several millennia from now, he's going to keep it. Well, what's so striking to me about that is, who on earth could be interested in that? Who on earth could care that long, long, long after I'm dead and buried, God is going to keep the promise that he made to my father Abraham?
What I might care about right then is that I'm being raped.
Exactly, exactly.
I might care. I do care, and that's what's really the center focus.
Exactly. And what the prophets are saying is, this is a watershed issue here. If you care more about your present safety than you do about the purposes of God, then you will not stand, Isaiah says in Isaiah 7. You will fall and not stand.
That is so radical.
It's incredibly radical.
It is so radical to say, I care more about the purposes of God and it's okay than to be raped.
That's what he's saying, ultimately. Obviously, we're not the struggle that you're talking about, how hard it would be, the confusion that I would go through. Obviously, that's all part of the process. But we're talking about, in the final analysis, when I sort out my life, when all has been figured out, can I finally say, I'm really thankful that God has not forsaken us? We're talking about his promises to the Jewish people. God has not forsaken us. He's going to keep his promise. Is that important to me, or does that strike me as utterly and completely irrelevant? If that's important to me, then I'm a unique person. I'm a very unusual person whose eyes God has opened. Why would that be important to me? Because if God has not forsaken Abraham with respect to those promises, then he also has not forsaken us, any of us, with respect to his more eternal promises. It's the same God who's promised both. that's why it's personally relevant to me, even though I'm not going to be around to enjoy it. The reason it's personally relevant to me is because the promises that are personally relevant to me are coming from the mouth of the same God. And it's absolutely vital to me, it's absolutely crucial to me that I know and be able to be have it affirmed that that God's word is trustworthy. And that's why it's so important. Because what is my life all about in the end? Not this world, not here, not now, but about my eternal existence in the kingdom of God. And that is vitally important to me at a personal level.
So what I've heard you say over and over again in this program is, look at the bigger picture.
Yes.
At the end of this century, the big questions about reality and being human rise with unexpected power. We ask, ever more agonizingly, what does it mean to be human? How do human beings fit into this vast cosmos? Where to from here? In his News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality, Mackenzie Study Center member Wes Hurd shows how our present-day culture answers these questions in radically non-biblical ways. He shows how the prevalent postmodern view of life is fed to us through television, popular music, and education. However, he also states that although postmodernism has many negative aspects, it may present opportunities for biblical Christians to dialogue more openly with people who need real answers to some big questions. Call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality.
One of the things the Study Center does is work very hard at trying to find ways to present the gospel to people that brings up questions that are relevant and important to them. There's an upcoming event called Oktoberfest, and I think it's trying to really get at that.
Yes. This year it's going to be on the topic generally of spirituality, a follow-up from the one we did last year. This is an annual event, and last year we explored the concept of spirituality. The reason being that spirituality seems to have emerged in our culture as an okay thing to talk about and to think about. It's talked about all the time on Oprah Winfrey these days. You have television programs like Touched by an Angel, and there's a new one out I just noticed recently that is not afraid to be other than secular, to acknowledge that something exists out there beyond us. And the problem, of course, is you can be interested in spirituality and not at all be interested in the gospel. So we're exploring what is really unique and distinctive and definitive about biblical spirituality in contrast to a more general vague spirituality that is acceptable to our culture.
So you're really going to define it?
Yeah, we didn't last year. I don't know if the papers this year will so much define it as carry on the discussion from last year and explore different aspects of it. It should be very interesting. I'm really looking forward to it.
What kind of people do you think would be interested in this?
Well, mostly believers who are wanting to get clearer on what exactly their faith does say and how their faith, how it is like and unlike all the other ideas that are out there in the marketplace of ideas. But I would hope that people who are interested in spirituality but don't even pretend to be Christians, but are at least open enough to finding out what Christianity has to say on the subject, that they too might be interested as well.
You know, recently we received a letter, Jack, to Christianity at Work by a person who described themselves as a, now you're going to help me out, a Jewish, radical,
Socialist. Or communist, atheist.
And yet had incredibly great questions.
Yes.
He started it out by saying, this is a letter you probably don't want to receive, and that's a letter we really wanted to receive. It was great.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of person who is kind of fighting about it, kind of thinking about it, really working with ideas of spirituality and or Christianity as they mix, I think it would be a fascinating conference, in particular because the people who are presenting are bright, intelligent, thoughtful people. And in fact, you're one of them, right?
I will be giving one paper.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You kind of sidestepped that one, didn't you? Yeah. And I think that people would have a really refreshing look, an intellectually stimulating and personally stimulating addition to their understanding of Christianity and spirituality.
I think so. I really enjoyed it last year, and I expect to be equally excited about this year.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts. What's the cost?
It costs $45 if the registration is received before the 13th of October. There's a cost break if you pre-register. It's going to be held at Grace Community Church in Eugene, Oregon, on Friday and Saturday, October 27th and 28th. They can contact the Study Center with their registration or for questions about it, 1883 University Street, or the phone number is area code 541-485-4801.
I hope that a lot of people are able to go. How many people usually go?
100 or so.
Really? Is that many?
Now, maybe it wasn't quite that big last year, but mm-hmm. we've had anywhere from 50 to 150, depending upon the year.
Okay. And I think there's some really nice accommodations that you guys have set up. There's some beautiful bed and breakfasts. Are you going to do that again this year around the study center?
Yeah, at least information about that. Uh-huh.
Okay. We hope to see you there.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of Mackenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.